Welcome back to the Waverton Y Invest podcast. It's me, Luke Hyde-Smith. Today we are delighted to be joined by two guests. The first, Victoria Stevens, is a UK equity fund manager at Lion Trust. Victoria is a member of the Economic Advantage team, led by Anthony Cross, and one of the longest standing UK equity fund managers and teams in the market, having managed UK equities for over 26 years. The team manages over 7 billion in AUM across the UK equity market, from FTSE 100 large caps through to micro caps, which gives them unique insights into the whole UK and indeed global marketplace. Victoria and the team have generated market leading returns, and it's great to have you on the podcast today. Secondly, we have Tinaka Frike, who specializes in UK equities and manages our UK equity fund. Member of the Waverton investment team, Tinaka, since joining Waverton, has markedly improved the fortunes of our UK equity fund, turning around performance from fourth quartile to first quartile through some excellent stock selection. Delighted to have you both on the podcast. Thank you very much for taking the time today. The UK equity market, where to from here? This seems to be the market everyone loves to hate. Before we get into the reasons and where we see the risks and opportunities, let's start with a brief intro. So Victoria, tell us a little bit about your career to date.
Thanks so much, Luke. And it's great to be here with you both today on the podcast. I'm delighted to be here. So my route into the industry was actually a bit roundabout, as is so often the case with these things. I started out my career after university actually in journalism. So I worked for a city newspaper, City AM, where I was both a reporter and also the diary editor. So my job there was going to a lot of parties and reporting back on gossip. So slightly different, I have to say, to what I get up to now. But relevant perhaps for the discussion we're having today with two women in the industry. The reason why I moved aside from that is because I met the boss of the first company that I then moved to, FinCap at the time, has now since become Cavendish Securities, a city stockbroker, which was run by a female entrepreneur, Sam Smith, who'd led a management buyout of that business. A very inspirational character. I was delighted to join her team in corporate broking at the time. And then from there, my first client was then Anthony Cross, who, as you mentioned, is now heading up our team and has been doing for decades. And I was fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to join his team at Lion Trust about 5 years later.
Fantastic. And Tinaka, over to you.
Sort of similarly roundabout, I got a health sciences degree, which is a great degree, but then I found out I actually don't like working in hospitals, which is a bit of an issue. So I did an MBA, did financial topics because I didn't know anything about them, then saw a headhunter at, oh, you're way too different for this role in asset management. And I thought, I'll show you. So I wrote a CV to Newton at the time and I got in. So that's how my career in fund management started. And I've loved it ever since. Always UK equities, even though at Waverton now I do some global equities as well. And we'll talk about that later, really sort of trying to do our bit to encourage more diversity in our fund management industry.
Great, great. Well, thank you both very much indeed. So let's get into it. I mean, the UK equity market, you know, every day we see something at the front page of the FT or other media just talking about the demise, the challenges of the UK. Some of the performance versus particularly the US market has been, you know, really difficult over the last few years. You know, why is that, Victoria? And what do you think are the reasons behind it?
Yeah, great question, Luke. So the first thing to say, of course, is that Brexit clearly didn't help with the international perception of the UK as a market. You know, this sort of idea that the UK had suddenly slammed the door voluntarily on the world's largest single market and the association of bringing increased costs, red tape, burdens for UK companies, both importers and exporters, which exceeded what had gone before. So that wasn't helpful. I think what we then had, of course, is it's been a period of significant political upheaval. Clearly, the last few years have been very difficult for investors globally anyway, with the challenges of the coronavirus pandemic and the associated aftermath. But in the UK, that sort of external perception of having had a number of people through the revolving door at number 10 has clearly given rise to this idea that the UK's stability perhaps was not what it could be. So I think where we find ourselves today is in the position where, you know, we've had a bit of a perfect storm for the UK. And the problem comes, therefore, with the impact of the outflows that have transpired. So what happens when you get, of course, persistent outflows from an equity market is that there's then pressure on share prices, pressure on company valuations, which causes a negative relative performance of that market versus other global markets. And it's a bit of a vicious circle because it reinforces that constant narrative of the fact that the UK underperforms, therefore we shouldn't allocate and we should move our allocations away. And the whole thing becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So really, I think for me at this point in time, flows and catalyzing inflows or even stopping the outflows is really the key.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some staggering stats out there, aren't there, about the pension schemes in the UK changing their allocation to UK equities from circa 50% plus 20, 30 years ago to low single digits. You've got the UK market being a smaller percentage of the global equity market. So investors think, you know, is it worth my time and effort spending as much time when it's such a small part of our benchmark, et cetera, and the rise of passive, right? So these vehicles tracking markets and following the US market. And as you say, a vicious sort of circle. It's like the stronger performing parts of the market engender more flows and perhaps areas which haven't performed as strongly, you know, lag. But I think where we are today is this elastic band has been stretched to such an extent that there is considerable value on offer.
I couldn't agree more. And that point you make, Luke, about the UK pension funds, it is a really valid one. What we saw in the recent budget, we thought, was that there'd been a marked shift in tone from the government, acknowledging that there is a problem. And of course, that's the first step in rectifying that problem, is to recognise that it's there in the first place. So we clearly had the announcement of a British ISA, which was welcomed by the team, having campaigned for that. But perhaps far more meaningful was the step up in rhetoric around pension funds, domestic pension funds allocations to the UK market, where there's obviously going to be brought in the requirement to disclose what the domestic allocation is. But more importantly, if the government then doesn't like what they see, then there was a significant sort of shot across the bows, if you like, to pension funds to say, we might do something about it. And, you know, you reference the sharp slide in domestic allocations from UK pension funds that's occurred over many, many years. But where we sit today, it's astonishing the degree to which the UK looks like an outlier on that front versus other global markets. There was a fascinating report that came out from the Capital Markets Industry Task Force, or CMIT, at the back end of last year, which effectively compared UK domestic pension fund allocations to their own domestic market versus other developed global markets. So the US had something like a 64% allocation to its own market, but clearly the US is a big part of an international benchmark. Yep. It was still kind of overweight. But even much, much smaller countries in terms of their percentage of the composition of the international market had vast over-allocations domestically still. Australia, such an outlier, something like 38% allocated to their domestic market. Italy at 41%, France at 24%, and the list goes on. And the UK, where we sit today, is at under 3%. So we really look like a staggering outlier here.
Well, maybe, I think Luke earlier touched on sort of valuation, and you and I have been around quite a while, because obviously the UK market looks optically cheap. Is that an opportunity? Is it a risk? How do you think about that?
I absolutely see that as an opportunity. There's many out there who sort of say, the FTSE is overweight the past and underweight the future. And is that a view that we share? No, it's not really. I mean, obviously, there is a large percent of the FTSE All Share benchmark that is allocated to sectors such as mining, energy, you know, and so on. People will inevitably see them banking. You know, together, those three sectors, mining, energy, and banking, make up over a quarter of the index. But as you rightly pointed out earlier, not all investing in the UK needs to be passive. Active management and actively seeking out the opportunities in our market can be very rewarding indeed. And I suppose from where we sit today, we think that there is such a clear opportunity to seek out great companies at really attractive valuations, especially if you can look past a slight degree of short-term volatility in earnings that's coming from, you know, a background that it is inevitably not as benign as it could be. So if you're an investor that is fortunate enough to have a medium to longer term time horizon, there are huge bargains on offer.
And what do we think about some of the recent announcements? You touched on it earlier. Maybe, Tinica, you could explore the ideas about the British ISA trying to engender more investment into the UK stock market. Do we think this sort of policy direction is a good idea, or should investors really be able to seek returns where they see the best opportunity?
could well be that we have a different point of view. I think the most important thing that there is an acknowledgement that we need to do better for our UK companies. And the angle that I would like to see more on is get more investment in growth and an R&D for UK companies so that UK companies can grow more, can get higher returns. And, you know, there are some great examples in the UK companies who do that. But in general, the percentage that's invested in R&D and growth capex just need to be higher. So I'd like that to go higher and there to be a more consistent long-term support. And that probably comes from other government initiatives, I would have thought, and tax credits, etc. Because I think ultimately where clients or investors invest their money, that needs to suit their risk profile, their investment horizon, and ultimately they need to pick the best stocks that they can that fit that. And I think forcing anyone to invest in something always feels a bit dangerous, because ultimately we want people to invest in those opportunities that make sense for them. And it could be US, it could be European, it could be UK. And I would love it to be UK.
Yeah, no, that I agree. That makes total sense. I think to have some draconian sort of oversight from the regulator or the government, etc., forcing people to invest in certain assets doesn't feel right. But as you said, Victoria, you know, just having a more domestic orientated pension scheme and investor base that say, look, actually, if we invest in our economy, in some of the businesses that are listed here, that engenders prosperity, wealth, and actually, you know, we do need a functioning and successful stock market for the UK economy to thrive. No doubt about it.
I think that's bang on. I mean, one thing that we've obviously seen happen is that as stock market valuations have slid in the UK, that has meant a very real sort of discrepancy between smaller companies or companies of all size, but we see it particularly in those smaller companies that find themselves vulnerable to being taken over at valuations which don't reflect their medium to longer term potential. And that's sad, I think, for the UK, because, you know, to your point, Nika, you know, what we really want to see is a thriving stock market that can continue to support these businesses through their journey on the market until they reach, hopefully, the FTSE 100. Back to the point we were making earlier about that perception of the UK being, you know, overweight the past, underweight the future. Well, it has well under 2% in the technology sector. And of course, that's a glaring difference with the US. I mean, the valuations of those technology giants in the US and just how far that's gone is a story for another question, perhaps. Mm. But in terms of where that leaves our smaller listed businesses, we need to get better at supporting them through that journey, not only in terms of allowing them the space to flourish and thrive on our market, but also catalyzing more interest in businesses at the IPO stage. That's been the real difference over the last couple of years, is that although we have continued to see an acceleration of businesses being taken off the market, often by foreign investors, we haven't had that IPO pipeline to replenish it. And I think that the danger of that self-fulfilling prophecy of lower valuations on the UK stock market and nothing being done to support UK businesses listed on the market is that that trend only accelerates further from here. So we're really passionate about the opportunity that we see in front of us at the moment. We're passionate in supporting our businesses on their growth paths. And we hope that, you know, where the government sees the opportunity to do so, not to mandate how people invest in the slightest, but where you're offering an explicit tax break at a cost to the UK taxpayer, I think that there is a good argument that some of that should come back into British businesses to help to boost longer term productivity and growth. And we have plenty of such businesses at their earlier stage sort of popping up around the country. We just need to get better at supporting them through that journey.
I think that makes total sense. I mean, we all know that good news doesn't sell, right? So, you know, we generally, certainly at the headline level, see the pervasive negative headlines. I think that's a great way to think about, okay, look, we can all see the evident value on offer. I'm sure you're going to talk about some of the huge successes, actually, that many smaller businesses in the UK have achieved and been recognized globally and grown into bigger companies. But, you know, let's talk about some of the catalysts, I guess, maybe from a macro perspective, which may result in investors looking at this undervalued UK market. We've been through a huge inflation scare, interest rate rises. Certainly in the UK and Europe, that seems to be abating. We're at peak interest rates. It does appear that the next move, you know, may be lower. What are you looking at in terms of, okay, what is the catalyst here for this undervaluation and these companies to be able to, you know, generate the type of shareholder returns that you'd like?
I think that, you know, what you mentioned about the fact that we've likely peaked, I mean, our interest rate journey, I mean, we're not an investment process that seeks to explicitly forecast the macro.
No.
Commentators widely agree that that is where we are. It's just that the disagreement comes in the potential pace and speed of interest rate cuts from here. But certainly that is a much more supportive backdrop for equities as an asset class generally, as you and our listeners will know, than an environment in which you're seeing rate rises. And that's particularly the case for companies which are at the longer duration or growth end of the spectrum, because of course they tend to enjoy higher valuations, but partly based on that longer term, higher growth trajectory. So certainly we feel that that is a much more supportive backdrop from a market valuation perspective. In terms of the underlying economy, we do see that hopefully things have bottomed out in terms of where companies have got to. I would not say it is yet a benign picture for every company. You know, there are certainly pockets of demand weakness that impact businesses, particularly those that are exposed to more discretionary areas of consumer and business spending. So we still see some of that. The inflationary pressures have absolutely eased, and that's been a narrative that has sort of gained pace over the last year. In terms of the easing of those inflationary pressures. But there are still pockets of that that are present for businesses to have to contend with. But the real point to be made, I think, is that it feels like that is now in the price and some.
Yeah, so indeed.
We feel that the stock market has more than priced in that short-term continuation of slight uncertainty. And of course, as we all know, the stock market tends to move in advance of the economic news.
Mm-hmm.
So in anticipation of what many businesses are describing as hopefully a more benign second half of 2024, we're hopeful that overall that provides a decent catalyst for equities in the coming year.
And elections coming up, is that something that is on your mind? Do you think it matters for UK equities?
I mean, again, we don't attempt to call which way it's going. I think from where we sit today, it seems very unlikely that we get another Conservative government, certainly based on most recent data points. I think the thing that's most useful for the stock market, given that we have two relatively centrist sort of options at the upcoming election, neither really want to stray too far from the path of that sort of centrist economic narrative, is that certainty after several years of upheaval will undoubtedly be helpful as a backdrop. The markets really hate uncertainty. And so if you get to the point where you have a stable political backdrop, I think that will be helpful. And certainly in conversations with companies who are already speaking to Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, we've heard that overall there is a feeling that they will be supportive to British business. They are certainly not an anti-business duo. So we hope that that will be optimistic for the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's certainly no shortage of catalysts to see coming down the pipeline to realise value. If we just change tack a little bit before we get back into, you know, some of the process and maybe some ideas for our listeners. I mean, you both represent leading and highly regarded women in the fund management industry. It seems to have been an industry where it's more male dominated, diversity is not great. I'd just like to ask you, A, why is that? And what can the industry do to, you know, improve things?
You have many thoughts on this, as I'm sure you can imagine. For me, part of the problem lies very early on in women's careers. I think there is this perception of financial services as this broad bucket of quite anti-female jobs and opportunities. I think there's this sort of overarching perception of a male-dominated, testosterone-fueled, quite aggressive environment on a trading floor that sort of pervades the entire industry, even though, of course, as we all know, there is a huge diversity of roles within our industry. And many of them, I mean, I've experienced it myself, you know, are fantastic and very conducive to women who want to have a family alongside pursuing a successful career. So I would say that one of the key things that we could do would be to try and increase awareness of that variety of roles within our industry and try to tackle that perception at an early stage. So perhaps at the stage of graduate recruitment, of university recruitment programs, also potentially even earlier than that, school outreach programs, for example.
I couldn't agree more. And actually, interestingly, today we have an event for 12 sixth formers, all girls. So we sponsor a business called Gain, who exactly tries to just tell girls that investment careers can be interesting, what they might look like. So we're all going to join in and just explain how we do. So education is very, very important. I always get a bit when I think back at how it was when I started in sort of 98. Nothing much has seemed to have changed. You know, ideally, we move in the right direction. But I think obviously culture of firms that we work for all need to be supportive. It's certainly what we look for also for companies we invest in. So the diversity needs to be right across, but we can only try to have an active role in it, in explain that these careers can actually be less difficult from a work-life balance. I mean, certainly when I think UK equities, for example, the market opens at 8 and it closes at 4:30. So it works quite well. So there's many careers that are probably more interesting than lots of girls think.
Absolutely. And I think there's another thing to pick up on, which you mentioned earlier, Snicker, about your slightly different degree path. There's this perception among girls, and it was very well put to me a few years ago by a business coach at the point where we were recruiting. And she said, you shouldn't spec your job that you want too tightly to discourage women from applying. And she said, well, the problem is that a man will look at a list of required skills, typically, and a list of ideal skills, and they'll sort of say, yep, I've got that, definitely got that. I might not have that one, but that's fine, I can learn it. And I might not have that one either, but I think I've got the tools to do that, so I'll apply. Whereas a woman typically will look at that job spec and go, yep, I think I've got that one, that's great, that's a tick. Oh, I'm not too sure about that one. I'm not sure that I'm very good at that. And actually that one as well, I can't necessarily see myself in. So they'll be put off from even applying for the job because they don't necessarily tick all the boxes. And I thought that was a really interesting point. And I think to recognize the fact that different degrees within our industry can provide really valuable different perspectives. We've got a broad range of different degrees on our team, from law through to PPE. I myself have a modern languages degree. My colleague Matt has an engineering degree. There is value in having that different perspective on the team, particularly when it comes to analyzing businesses operating in the real world in a number of different sectors. So I think that would be great to emphasize to girls at an earlier stage of their career path as well. You know, you don't necessarily have to tick boxes of maths and further maths in order to have a job in financial services. You can come into it through a slightly more roundabout way, and it's still very valuable to your longer term career prospects.
I think those are really, really fascinating and good points. The other thing I think is going to hopefully play a role here is the increased use of technology. I think we've all started in this industry when it was basically you had to be at your desk to be seen to be working. There was no really work from home. There was no ability to do that because the technology wasn't there. So being able to have some element of flexibility is a useful and valuable part of what is actually quite an intense job in terms of analyzing companies, investing, but it doesn't necessarily fall into a, you know, 8 a.m. to 4:30. It's much more, you know, you can do reading, you can do your report writing at times, which maybe, you know, suit you and one's life better.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But even I'm sort of thinking back before the working from home became a thing, and I would be at the sports day of my child's field and just make some phone calls, and then you just make up for it. I mean, this is sort of an industry that obviously the people are key. And if we take our people serious, then we need to provide them with their own responsibility to do their job well. So you're at the sports fields with your kid in the morning, and then you work a bit later at night and you work it out. But it's an interesting point that you make, because ultimately diversity of perspectives is what we're after. And obviously, you know, we talked about the sort of the male, female, but it goes much broader. I came at it from having a Dutch perspective. It's interesting that we can also write our job specs with a different mindset.
Yes, absolutely vital. So let's just delve into your role, your team's process, if you like, for looking at the UK equity market. You're in quite a unique spot insofar as you look at FTSE 100 large cap Shell-esque or energy companies through to right down to the micro cap. Talk to us about how you filter out those businesses that you want to take a closer look at and those that you think perhaps, you know, are ones that don't fit what you'd look for in terms of an investment idea.
Absolutely. So we have four unit trust funds that, as you say, address the whole of the UK equity market spectrum. Our Liontrust UK Growth Fund focuses more on the large and mid caps. So it has some 70% of its NAV invested in large cap businesses here in the UK. Our flagship Liontrust Special Situations Fund is an all-cap vehicle that commits to having 20 to 30% of its NAV invested in small caps, but also typically has over 40% in large cap and the balance in the mid-cap companies. And then we have a Liontrust UK Smaller Companies Fund, does what it says on the tin, and a Liontrust UK Microcap Fund, right at the weeny end of the spectrum for the smallest businesses listed on the market. But the investment process is consistent across all four of those funds. And at its heart, what we're looking for is businesses that are rich in intellectual capital or intangible asset strengths that we think are going to give them in this enduring competitive advantage that, if they can maintain it for a number of years, will be hugely rewarding for you as an investor if you can get on that virtuous circle of them compounding out their growth over many, many years. So we prioritize three different intangible assets that we look for: intellectual property, strength in distribution, and high levels of recurring income that form a gateway for any company into our funds. But then we'll also be looking at businesses, other intangible assets as well, things like the culture of the business, their customer relationships, procedural or format skills, and so on and so forth. And we'll then ally that first stage of the process, that search for the intellectual capital barrier to competition, with an objective test in the form of looking at the business's returns on invested capital, looking for businesses that are consistently able to earn a return on invested capital, which is in excess of their cost of capital over the course of the economic cycle. Value creators in an economic sense, in other words. And we really love this idea that these innovative businesses can then reinvest those excess returns back into whatever it was that they were doing in the first place to help power that long-term journey of compounding and growth.
And if I was to ask you for a particular company that perhaps highlights that process in a concentrated manner, is there one company or a number of them that come to mind?
Yes. So one that always springs to mind when we're asked that question is a business called Renishaw, which is a FTSE 250 engineering business. It's a specialist in the area of metrology, or measuring things. So it makes these measurement probes that can test parts or other things to very tight tolerances. Also has a separate business involved in additive manufacturing, or 3D metal printing, to give it its colloquial name. And Renishaw is a business that my boss, Anthony Cross, invested in before he turned up at Lion Trust in the late 1990s. And he's seen it through all the way from a very small cap business through to a business which has taken that core intellectual property out to a global marketplace and built that strength of distribution based upon that patented IP. And that's the kind of business that we really love. Another element to Renishaw, which is a really interesting one, actually, and quite a rarity as you move up the market cap chain, though it's very prevalent down at the small cap end and we specifically target, is this idea of being aligned with owner managers of our businesses. So we have a rule that applies to all of the small caps held across all of our funds and micro caps, which is that they have to have a minimum 3% invested by the management teams in their own equity. So that's direct equity, not options. And we think that's fantastic for a number of reasons. The alignment piece with us as long-term shareholders, it makes them also very conservative stewards of that capital as well. They tend to take on less debt and do fewer of those big risky transformational acquisitions. And Renishaw is an example of a business where the two founders today still hold circa half of the equity of the business, even though it is now a business that is a mid-cap on the market. And that stake is clearly worth an awful lot of money. And I think at every turn, you can see how that mentality of the long-term value creation, that trying to take away the short-term noise and invest in the business, make sure that you have that long-term time horizon in your mind, is so clear to see when you look at Renishaw and its performance over the years and how it's navigated its way through the cycle as a business which is inevitably, as an engineering company, subject to certain vagaries of the economic cycle.
Yeah, great. I mean, certainly a company for our listeners to keep an eye on. Tinica, what's been behind the success of the performance you've achieved on the UK fund, and how do you think about both selecting the companies but also putting the portfolio together in terms of portfolio construction?
I think in terms of the investment process, there is an overlap with what Victoria talked about. So really wanting companies to have an edge in what they do and have a confidence that they will be able to do that in a profitable way for a number of years. And when I joined Waverton, there were a number of stocks that I felt didn't have that. So as Victoria will know, it's also sometimes about names you don't have in your fund. So you need to be selective. So needless to say, there was quite a bit of selling of names that I felt were too risky in terms of the reward that they might pick. So ultimately, it's, you sort of pick your winners, and a competitive edge is important. And ultimately, it then comes out, well, you know, how much free cash flow is then grown on the back of that advantage. And it can be through different angles. But that was really another layer that I added, and another thing that I think is absolutely critical, because you can hear the strategy, you can hear the edge. Management needs to be aligned, and governance is just so important. So that probability that this company will do well based on what they've got is quite high. So there were some companies where I had my doubts about the alignment of the board with us as shareholders. So again, it's really focusing in what you really want and putting your weight behind that, and then being patient, because the last couple of years have been a bit rocky, right? With COVID and then the invasion of Ukraine. So you have to sort of stick to your conviction, even though the markets might be behind it. And often in the deepest, darkest hours, that's when you build your positions. And those are some of the stocks that probably have given most of the returns, buying a stock when it's never been cheaper.
And that makes sense. I think one of the issues perhaps in the broader market today is that it is incredibly short-term focused. It's dominated, as we've discussed, a little bit by passive, which can be quick money in and out of markets and indices, depending on, you know, very short-term moves. It's dominated by sort of the trading aspect of things, like, you know, high-frequency traders trying to game and get an edge in very, very short-term stock moves. And then you've got the trend followers. So people are literally just investing based on the fact that price is moving one particular way, being an up or down. So being able to take a long-term view, being able to hold positions, particularly if you're comfortable with the company and how they're delivering, is, I guess, a little bit of a rarer thing in some parts of the market. And I think we've definitely seen some challenges over active management. But I guess both of you would be of the view that presents quite a compelling opportunity from here.
I think that's right. I don't know about Victoria, but we certainly don't feel we have an edge in the short term, because we don't really know what is around the corner. So it is about an investment horizon of 2 to 3 years and holding your breath and maybe buying more as the shares go down. Not sure what Victoria's view on that is.
I could not agree more. You know, I think that so often the market is focused on, you know, half yearly or quarterly earnings, and have they slightly missed or have they slightly beaten? And the share price reaction to that can be magnitudes greater than the impact on the company's earnings, even in that short term period. So sentiment-driven sort of price moves can be very volatile indeed. But absolutely, to your points, you know, that's the opportunity for active management, and in particular, active management that takes that longer-term view. I think for us, you know, invested in these businesses that do have that real long-term view of innovating and investing in their businesses with long-term capital appreciation in mind, you know, that can be so rewarding if you're able to try and block out that short-term noise. So I'm very much aligned with the two of you on that.
Okay, excellent. So without wanting to put you both on the spot too much, if you were allowed to have one investment for the next 10 years, invest in it now, lock it away, don't see it. If I ask you first, Victoria, what would that be?
Yeah, it's an impossible question, Luke, as you know.
It's a really mean question, I'm sorry. But
it absolutely is. I mean, I start there by thinking about the characteristics of the business that I would want to pick. For me, it would be a business that is run by an owner manager with that long-term mentality in mind. And so I sort of naturally gravitate towards our small cap businesses that many of them still have that attribute of high ownership. I think it would also be a business that adheres to some of the key things that have delivered so much value for the process over time. So some of that might be those IP-rich engineering businesses like Renishaw. But another point, another trend or another attribute, if you like, that has delivered a huge amount of value for us is investing in these businesses that exploit the power of proprietary data sets. And that, of course, is a very interesting sort of side point to make in an environment where investors are increasingly wary of the impact of AI on business models across a multitude of sectors. So I think that ownership of data, that exploiting of data aligned with an owner-manager ethos and culture would be my sort of 2 points where I would look for my idea. And so therefore, I think the one that I would pick that hits on both those fronts is a business called Global Data, which is a business that is still majority owned by its founder and has been for many years. I think it's a business that's very interesting at the juncture we find ourselves today with AI. You know, it's a business that effectively delivers specialist research for a multitude of different end markets, so to 20 different end markets, and it's delivering that research to business customers in those verticals. It's leveraging the power, yes, of analysts and data scientists across all of those verticals, but also leverages it from the power of proprietary data sets in specialist areas. pharmaceutical drug pricing would be just one example there. And so I think the combination of those two attributes mean that I'd be happy to lock that away in my proverbial drawer and yes. come back to it in 10 years' time, and hopefully I'll have made a lot of money from it.
Well, you heard it here first, listeners. So thank you for that. And how about you, Tenneke?
I'm actually going to not answer it, because I think who knows what happens in 10 years' time. I think looking at attributes, I think, is vital, and particularly with, you know, we're at the foothills of what generative AI may or may not do, and who knows what else comes. One of the critical things that we look for in our companies is innovation, so that when things change, a company can change, can adapt, can maybe create new products on the back of it. So I think that's sort of an essential box to tick for all companies in order to make it through 10 years. Because some businesses might be sidelined, or they're great, they might be bought, so they no longer exist. So I would emphasize how important it is for companies to keep innovating, maybe the products they sell, maybe the way they sell it. Because one thing we know for certain is that change will happen, and we need our companies to adapt to that and thrive in it.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. It's a rapidly, rapidly changing environment, and who knows where we'll be in 10 years. So I appreciate it's a difficult question. I'll answer the question for you, for the listeners. People could do a lot worse than owning the Waverton UK Equity Fund.
Thank you, Luke.
So look, you have both been very generous with your time. I have got one final question, and I think this helps our, you know, listeners, perhaps maybe some who are thinking about starting out on their career journeys, etc. You know, if you were looking back to towards the end of your school or your university, or thinking about your career, you know, what would be the sort of one bit of advice or thought you would give to people or yourself at that time?
I think for me, it would be, don't be afraid to be yourself. So many young people worry so much about what their peers are achieving, comparing themselves endlessly to where they thought they might be at certain stages, or what boxes they thought they should have ticked. Actually, it's so important in investment, which is a long-term game, to just really reflect on what makes you tick, what your key strengths and weaknesses are, so that you can really be yourself and feel comfortable in your chosen field.
What I would sort of add, and what we say to our kids, is kind of have a go, roll the dice. Don't read all those things on a job description, but just have a go and try it, see what happens. So just go for it, create options for yourself. And the worst case, it doesn't work. In the best case, you got a fantastic career you've never heard of. So, yeah.
That's a fantastic place to end the podcast. You know, really uplifting, I think, in terms of thoughts about how to approach a career and the opportunities, I guess, that are available, particularly in the investment world. And I'd just like to say thank you very much for taking the time.
Great to be here. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Why Invest podcast with me, Luke Hyde-Smith, and our guests this week, Victoria Stevens and Tenneke Fricke. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not like us, subscribe, and let your friends and colleagues know.
The information provided does not constitute investment advice, and it should not be relied on as such. It should not be considered a solicitation to buy or an offer to sell a security.